Amber, thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I'm feeling very professional. We've actually got the headphones on.
Yes, we have. We don't want any more disasters.
We don't want any more. This is going to be the best sound recording we've ever done. So, on my research, I read that you have once said that people are born with one dependable tool in their toolbox.
So true.
But I actually beg to differ with you.
Oh.
I think you've got a lot of tools in your toolbox.
I wonder what you were going to say then.
Seriously, you are a phenomenal writer, awesome curator, and I love the way you call yourself an art hustler. Which I think it's a great name for a show. Might have to steal that. But you really are, honestly. And I wondered if you could sort of tell us a little bit about your art hustling. What do you mean?
It's just
by
a term I made up to explain everything without being too detailed. Because I think for a while there I was doing so many things. I was writing for magazines and curating and doing a bit of PR and helping connect artists with galleries, and I didn't know what to call it, so I just called it hustling, and it seemed to fit.
Yeah, definitely. I think it fits beautifully because it is, and it's such a unique job to be that connector.
Yeah.
Connector of...
It's a made-up job.
Yeah.
It's the hardest job.
Well, it's like artists as well. It's that's a made-up job most of the time, isn't it? It's how did you... make your job up?
Well, I was a writer before I was a curator. And I was, once upon a time I had a corporate career, which I gave up when I turned 30 because I really decided that was not for me. And prior to that I had been doing some arts writing on the side just to keep that part of my brain alive, and decided that's what I wanted to do full time. So I shoehorned myself into various freelance writing jobs, and I was writing for the Design Files and Country Style and
Love the Design Files.
Yeah, lots of beautiful magazines where I got to interview creatives, which was really what I loved, and I was naturally curious and they were my people. And I think what came out of that was that there's a lot of creative people who don't know how to put themselves out there. They don't know how to find...
I think she's looking at two of them.
We're getting ourselves out there.
We're getting out. Look at you. Yeah, I think there were people who just were amazing creatives at whatever it was that they were doing, ceramics, painting, weaving, but were very comfortable in their own creative space but didn't quite know how to put themselves out there apart from maybe posting the odd picture on Instagram. So I took it upon myself to sort of assist. And then I found a lot of emerging artists who just had all this work and didn't have the means to show it. They weren't represented. Didn't quite know how to approach a gallery. So I decided to put on a show, which I did once. And it was fun and it sold out. And I thought, that was good. I might do that again. And I think that was 100 shows ago.
Where was that first show?
At St. Cloche. So at the time, St. Cloche wasn't built. But I had this concept for a show and they were building something, and I approached the director there, Kitty Clark, and said, "What are you building?" And she said, "Oh, it's sort of a concept space / cafe." And I said, "Well, I've got this great idea for a show." And she goes, "Great, I've got this space, but no show. Let's collaborate."
Brilliant.
And the rest is history.
So wow. was that, that wasn't the current site, the Paddington?
Yep.
That's such a great space because it's on the corner.
Exactly.
It's
a bit like the Michael Reed one in Newport, actually,
it's
isn't it?
It's not dissimilar.
On the corner. Yeah.
Bright and welcoming.
That's right. That's right. And I think the other thing that motivated me was it's much more widespread now to have little pop-up galleries and smaller artist-run spaces and, I don't know, art is more deconstructed now.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
At the time I was doing this, there was really just the high-end commercial white box galleries. There wasn't a lot of people doing what I was doing, and particularly with ceramics, no one was really showing ceramics at the time. So it just felt like I cottoned onto something that there was an audience for and ran with it.
So had you ever put any art on the wall before you did that? Like, was that your first sort of curation?
Made
it up. Love it.
I made it up and just sort of used the tools that I had at my disposal.
So did you come from a family where there were lots of lovely things around?
Yeah, I came from an art-loving household, and I think that was just natural, and I always remember tottering behind my mum to various galleries and always loved that. But I never thought that was going to be my job. I always thought I was going to be a writer.
Well, you are a writer.
Yeah, I am now. Yeah. I took a long way. I think everyone at school expected that I would go on to be a writer. And I think I fell into that trap that a lot of nearly 18-year-olds do, and they get a good HSC mark and they think, oh, I better not waste that doing something. I'll go and do something really lofty. And I sort of went into studying psychology. There was a brand new Bachelor of Psychology at Sydney Uni, and only 20 people got in. And I thought, oh, that sounds really woke and smart, and I could be a psychologist. But that involves a lot of maths and rats, and I don't like either of those things.
Maths?
Yeah.
Why?
It's all maths.
In what? Because you did psychology and economics, yeah?
Mm. And psychology is all statistics and finite maths and calculus. And,
didn't even think of that.
Yeah. Yes, I thought it was a lot more people, but it's not a lot of people. It's a lot of maths.
How bizarre.
Because I would have thought that would have been a great... my understanding was that it was a good... people skill.
You'd think so.
Well, that sort of ruins that question, Jill.
Well, not really. The question was, do you think it's helped you understand people and business doing a psychology degree?
Not so much for me, but I think that the corporate experience in dealing with people and problem solving and project managing has certainly transferred into what I'm doing now, and I think I'm very organized, and I think I can manage a lot of work and multiple people and tasks and times. And I think that sort of if I'd gone straight into writing and curations fresh out of uni, I might not have made it work quite so well.
And do you think motherhood has definitely helped with that as well, because you clearly can spin a lot of plates at once, so.
Well, it takes a village to raise children, doesn't
it? It does,
and
definitely.
I've got a pretty domesticated husband who does a lot of the grunt work there. Which
married a pom, we've all...
Yes, I did marry a pom. Mm-hmm. Yep. And he's an amazing cook and likes to clean, so that frees up a lot of time for the things I do.
Are you kidding me? Well done. Mm. When I popped into the gallery that you've opened, the Michael Reed, in Newport, we were having a conversation, and I said that you do spin a lot of plates and you're very busy... your books and you're creating, how do you do it? And you're like, I get up at 2 a.m. And I haven't stopped thinking about it since. Fascinated. I'm like, I've set my alarm half an hour earlier. That's all I could do. But I'm like...
So she's up at midday now.
Yeah. Genius, Amber. So you get a lot done.
Yeah. I don't care much for sleep, and I don't think I've been a big sleeper ever. I don't remember... sleeping much at school or enjoying a sleep in all through uni, and I think I've just learnt to run off not much. And once I wake up, or if I go to bed with a full head of ideas, once that idea pops in my head, I've got to get up and do something with it. And if that means getting up and doing a few hours of work before the kids get up, or going for a really early morning run before the sun, so be it.
That is so clever.
It's frustrating to sit around doing nothing.
Definitely. And it's so empowering. Jenny and I had a long discussion about how you can either look at, oh, I can't sleep, which I think a lot of us women, you know, suffer from in later years. I'm a bit older than both of you, I think. But I think you can either look at it that you can lie there and get pissed off with the situation, or you can embrace it and go, right.
You have to lean into it.
Yeah.
Brilliant. There's nothing worse than lying in bed thinking, I can't sleep, and watching the time tick by.
Just get up and get
on. If you get up, it's a beautiful time to be up, and you're the only person up, and it feels like you've got the whole world to yourself, and you watch that, you know, the lights around you twinkling as start, you know, neighbours start to wake, and all those lovely little
It's a
things.
Magical time of day early in the morning. I always remember when I was at art college that we'd often be up because we hadn't been to bed.
Yeah.
It's just unique. You can't, it's quiet and the light is stunning
that's
at that time of day.
And that's why I really love the morning runs. I did have to stop them during winter. I'm not a cold person. I don't like to be cold. So I did stay in bed a bit more during winter. But as soon as it got warm again, going down to the beach at 5, running for an hour, before the sun comes up. I know everyone gets excited about the moment the sun pops up, but it's the magic before that.
That's half light.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the air is electric, and it's so inspiring and motivating and head cleansing and all of those things. And if you've got a hangover, it washes it away, and you know, you start the day.
Amazing. Amazing.
But lots of very successful people don't sleep very much. I think there's a lot in that.
Yeah, my mum's the same. She's, I think, just from a family of non-sleepers.
So did she ever give you any advice? Like, did she ever say to you, don't fight it, just work with it? Or have you just come to that by yourself?
I think I've just come to that. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you've taken that into your other life as well. Like, you know, saying, you know, you just put on a show and curated it yourself. Mm-hmm. You're like, don't fight it. Do what you're going to do and just go for it.
There's a saying in my family that I was born with my hand on my hip, and I just
I love
just
that.
Do what I like.
What about double hip? Yeah. Farmer's wife.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So I think that I don't think I'm completely obnoxious, but I don't like to be told, and I like to do what I want. I'm usually right.
Yes, good
down,
on you.
I know I'm right.
Good on you.
Strong woman, I think.
I'm very similar. I do not like being told what to do.
I know.
From my dad. Always telling me what to do, and I don't like it. My husband knows.
My children can't listen to this.
And your friends know as well.
Nothing wrong with being a strong woman. But I think the other thing is that because I didn't come from a formal training in curation and running galleries and putting on shows and artist relations, if you don't know what you don't know, then you're free to do what you like. There's no rule book.
Go from your gut and keep running it. I mean, your success is clear. You know, you're doing it right because you've made a great success of it.
Yeah. And there's not a day that I'm not grateful for that. I just, you know, the other day I was having drinks with some girlfriends after work, and they were so tired and stressed and whinging about their jobs and hating it, and they looked a wreck, and I just thought, gosh, I'm lucky. I never feel like... Sometimes I'm a bit tired, you know, when the book's on deadline and I've also got sick kids and writing in the middle of a pandemic and I've also got to, you know, put a show on or something. There's never a time where I just hate what I'm doing.
So how did you make that decision to leave the corporate world and go out by yourself? Because that's a hugely brave thing to do.
I was just so stressed and tired and travelling all the time, and I never saw my husband, and I was just, you know, sitting in boardrooms with boring men talking a lot of jargon and socialising documents and silver bullets and all that rubbish talk. And I just couldn't even imagine, this was pre-kids, I couldn't even imagine how I could be happy or see my husband, or when would I have time for children, and just decided to pause. I think I read an article about a woman who did that, and it just inspired me, and my husband was very supportive and said, yep, quit your job, think about it. And I just sort of changed gears, and I did go and work with Jamie Durie for a couple of years.
Oh, did you?
I love Jamie Durie.
He lives up here.
Oh, yeah. Which was great, and I sort of did writing for him and worked on special projects and developed an iPhone, plant iPhone app for North America, and did all sorts of lovely things.
Oh, wow.
And I worked for Lisa Messenger in publishing, and I worked for Arendt and Pike, the beautiful interior designers, and helped them with their communications. And I think, and then the writing, I don't know. One day, it wasn't a conscious decision. I think it just naturally happened. You know, each thing you do leads to the next. And
that's right. And everything you've done sounds like a perfect little experience for what you do now.
Yeah.
Arendt and Pike, interior design, art shows. It's all comes together.
That's right. And I met a lot of artists doing that. Every job you do, you meet someone that puts a tool in your toolbox. If we want to,
you're very full toolbox.
She's got a very full toolbox.
Need a bigger one.
Yep. And I think if you just continue learning, I never think, you know, I'm winning at this. I always, you know, I'm always nervous about the next show or the next book or the next interview.
That's because you care. I think that when you don't care, then you don't get nervous.
That's right.
But you're excited, and I think nerves, you know, can be excitement as much as anything. But you're clearly very passionate about nature, am I right in that? And you love your garden.
Love my garden.
Did Jamie Durie teach you?
No, I think I loved working with him because I already had that passion. Again,
I'm such a shit gardener. I can't.
I kill everything
alive. Oh, really? We both do. We like have no green thumbs.
Oh no, I just, again, coming from garden loving family, it just, I don't know, it just was in my genetic makeup. I love it. It's my yoga. Sometimes when I'm at home and I'm on book deadline and I'm pumping out chapters and maybe I've just got a bit of a mental blockage, I just go out and do something in the garden.
Is it like, is that 3 in the morning?
No, during the sunlight hours, yeah.
Is it do you think it's little and often? Like pottering, yes, I think, pottering is probably the success. Whereas my friends come over and they go, V, they're all dying because you don't water them. And then you have to water them every day.
That's right.
Just like the kids.
Well, the first thing I do when I wake up after I've done my run is I come back and I have my coffee, and I take my coffee out to the garden and I see what's happening, you know, what's flowering, what's budding, what's seeding, what's, you know, it's
you do have a green thumb, like you have some amazing Instagram photos of the biggest sweet peas I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, they're taller than the house.
They're mind-blowing. Do you think where you live you've got good soil or
No, because I mean even when we lived in Sydney it was the same. It's the love you put in.
Totally.
They don't need much.
No,
bit of attention, bit of water,
and you just need knowledge. That plant over there I've kept alive for about 10 years because someone told me, do not water at the top, water That's down so the true. Side so it sucks up from the bottom. That is all I need. It's just the little bits of knowledge.
Cactus.
I
think it's a bit like the only thing I can have. Cactus.
I know, I kill a cactus, love.
It's very therapeutic, though. And I know when I'm stressed because I'll go and reclaim another strip of the lawn. I just dig a bit of lawn up and put in a new garden. Yeah. And that's when I know, I'm probably a bit tired and a bit stressed
now. Funny. Mm. So I do a lot of baking when I'm... I find it really relaxing, just that...
And knowing. I do a lot of eating of Julie's baking.
Yeah, that's what happens. But what advice would you have for people buying art?
Buy what you love. Yeah. Don't overthink it. We have a lot of people come into the gallery and they agonise over it. And I think they're thinking, will it match my house? What will my friends think? Do I have a spot for it? None of that matters. You just need to love that painting.
I agree.
And if I see a painting, it makes my heart race and I can't bear the thought of somebody else owning it. I know that that's the painting for me. And I think if people have that same sort of visceral reaction to a painting, go for it.
I agree. I think I love the hashtag buy what you love or, you know, just buy art. I think you never regret buying a painting.
I don't have anything in my home that I've thought, oh, gosh, I wish I didn't buy that.
Yeah,
Never. No.
And what advice would you give to people, other than if you love it, buy it, if they're trying to start a collection? Would you... Is there sort of any...
I think it's really exciting to support emerging artists and to buy artists at the beginning, buy work from artists at the beginning of their career. I think that's a nice way of growing your collection, and when you've had that piece in your home for 10 years and you've seen that artist go from street, there's a certain satisfaction in knowing that you were there from the beginning. I think it's such a personal thing. I just think you just need to buy what you love and...
And then it can't go wrong.
Nothing else matters.
Have you seen, like, since you had that first exhibition to now, have you seen a massive trend in online buying rather than seeing it and buying?
I wouldn't have said so back then, but definitely the last 18 months, and particularly through COVID, anyone who had any reservation about buying online, that's gone.
Yeah.
And, you know, for... I think there was fear about what would happen to artists during this time, but I can say that gallery sales have never been more buoyant. We with the Studio Direct program, which is the emerging art program I do with Michael Reed, we used to do a monthly exhibition, and then we had to make that 2 a month to cater to the demand for artwork during this sort of lockdown year, and then we had to do a weekly stockroom release of new works because people were frustrated that we kept running out and everything kept selling out. So it's a great time to be an artist, and I think that people who maybe weren't buying art before are now, because they're reallocating their funds. They've got a taste for it. You know, they've got the bug. They might have bought their first painting, and then that's sort of made them interested in art more generally, and they're buying.
I think a lot of people have a genuine fear of making the decision, or, you know, maybe they haven't purchased, you know, original art before, and like you say, they're worried about what their friends might think, or what, making the wrong decision.
The wrong decision is to get all your family portraits framed and hang them throughout the house.
The wrong decision is to even mention that word, family portrait. Julie and I had a bit of a chat about that the other day, about how we don't have photos of our children.
I see them all the time. I don't need to see them on the walls.
I actually would throw darts at them sometimes.
I'm done.
Yeah. Why do I need a photo of them?
Can't do it.
Always looking, not themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So Studio Michael Reid Direct is the emerging, as you say, arm of Michael Reid Galleries. Mm. We're so excited that they've just opened one in Newport. Mm. How do you go about choosing artists to go into Michael Reid Direct?
I get asked this a lot, and I think this is the magic question everyone wants to know.
What do we have to do, Amber? I'll just say it as it is.
I think it's really important to know that spamming a curator through Instagram is not the right way to get their attention, because you'll either annoy me or I'll forget that you've sent me that message, because it'll get buried under other things.
You're going to have to stop doing that, Fee. I've told you before.
It's all right. I did it under my other name. It's all good.
No, look, my biggest advice for emerging artists, and when someone does it well, it is such a joy. Send the gallery, send me an email, introduce yourself. Yeah, champagne works. Send me 5 amazing images of work that you've done. Tell me why you want to show with this gallery over any other gallery, and tell me a bit about yourself. It doesn't take much, but, you know, people sometimes wander in with their boards, shorts and thongs and a towel. How do I get a show in this gallery? You know, like, it's like a job interview. You have to put your best foot forward.
I agree.
And you'll never forget that first impression.
Do you think it's something that is not really taught at art schools?
Yes.
Because surely they need to be told. Like, I wouldn't have a clue how to approach a gallery. Like, I literally wouldn't have, apart from Googling it. I also did some weird art degree, so it's not surprising. I did architectural stained glass, but that's a whole different ball game. Stained glass windows, yeah. I was very drunk for 3 years. So, yeah, it's something that I think needs to be really... And look, I might be totally wrong. We're going to interview someone that's at uni next week. Mm. Because it's fascinating. What are they teaching you about those really practical things at art school?
And it's so funny you say this, because I've been speaking with my gallery manager, Amy, about this very thing. And next year we're actually going to hold a wine and cheese information night for new graduates to come and ask me anything. Brilliant. Because we get the same questions all the time. And when I'm showing an emerging artist, and they might be an amazing painter and very accomplished and with honours and all the rest of it, but they don't have an ABN and they didn't know how to invoice me for and just the basics of business for artists, which doesn't...
It makes, so you want the package. You need someone who's semi-professional, can, you know, get it framed or whatever, you know, is just on that level of being...
There has to be a little bit of admin skill.
Yeah.
There has to be.
Yes.
You can't play the dizzy artist. No. You know, it doesn't wash anymore, does
it? No, because it just... Because we're working with us, I mean, we're working on shows into 2022 at the moment, and we're project managing all these shows and different artists and so many people we're communicating with day to day. I can't have a dizzy artist throwing chaos into the mix because it's just makes it stressful for everyone.
Yeah. So you need someone to show up, do the work, make the work done in time.
Yeah. Deliver and it wet.
Just professional.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And I try and make it easy. I give templates and time frames and checklists and all that sort of thing. But not everyone will follow that. But I think that's the basics and that's the expectation. If you want to show with a gallery, you kind of have to get into that.
And how do you get yourself seen within... There are so many great artists out there at the moment. I mean, I get overwhelmed by getting sucked down the rabbit hole.
There are so many. And I was just saying, you know, you think a whole fresh year is this huge expanse of time, but I can fill up a year with shows so quickly.
Yep.
I almost panic because I've, you know, what if I find another amazing artist? Where am I going to fit them? Because there is so many. And I do go sometimes in those hours when I can't sleep and I'm doing my research, I do tumble down rabbit holes of, you know, I might jump onto Instagram and find an artist that I love, and then I look at who they're following or who's following them or who commenting, and look at a hashtag Australian artist or emerging art, and I can, you know, find all sorts of
things.
Oh, there
are so many great artists out there.
The grad shows are also a good source of finding unrepresented new artists, art prizes.
Yeah. Is there anything that Michael Reid Direct is not willing to show?
Well, I guess at the moment I haven't shown photography. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michael Reid Sydney, they really specialise in high-end photography. I haven't gone there. But we are looking to include more Indigenous emerging artists in our stable moving forward. Yeah, and obviously ceramics is a big part too. So when I started with Michael Reed, the program was about emerging artists, but then obviously I've got such a passion for ceramics and wrote the book Clay that Michael
Where did your love of ceramics come from?
Look, I don't really know, but I suspect it's this really what I thought was a hideous vase that was in my family household I can't remember life without it, and it was made by my mum's uncle out of clay that he dug up from the bush at the end of my childhood home. And
I've still got it.
It's my absolute pride and joy now. And it's this big round thing dripping in glaze, and I always thought it was hideous and hated it and was a bit embarrassing. But then when I left home, I just wanted it so much. And it's one of those things that if the house burnt down, if the house was on fire, I'd grab that and the baby albums and I'd be out of there.
Yeah.
It's my favourite thing. And I think that maybe just... I don't know, just whet my appetite a little bit.
It grew on you. And you've written the book Clay, which is, we were saying how, like, what an emergence ceramics is having at the moment. Where do you think that's come from? Is it, like, just, you know, things going trends or...?
Well, I think ceramics and pottery have been around forever and they've come and go. But I think the current wave of ceramics is really a retaliation to this very... highly digitized online virtual world that we're living in at the moment, where everything's a bit mass produced and it's just not, there's not a lot that you can buy that's particularly handmade. And I don't think it's just limited to ceramics, it's bread and beer and all those things.
That's true. Yeah.
And I think that there's just something gorgeous about a wonky mug or an imperfect vase or a perfect vase.
Totally.
And they're all so different and they've all got so much personality.
And they're tactile and maybe it's that sort of connection. I've collected quite a lot of handmade mugs and there's nothing more lovely than a cup of tea or a glass of wine or whatever you want to drink out of a handmade vessel.
Absolutely. And I love seeing people come into the gallery with ceramics and they instantly touch them. It doesn't make me nervous because I actually love that connection that they have, that they're not even thinking. It's just an instinct to reach out and touch a piece of ceramic, and knowing that the love that's been put into that by a ceramicist, and they all start with the same block of clay and it all ends up in... I mean, I think there's a lot of painters who sort of paint in a similar way and there's similar palettes, but I don't know, there's something about ceramics where it's just...
goes from that... a lump of dirt, really.
Correct, yeah.
And then you can make these beautiful vessels. But how do you go about displaying them? I am not very good at that side of things at home. I'm nervous about buying ceramics because I think...
people are.
What am I going to do? The kids are going to knock it over.
The first time ceramic buyers come into the gallery and they always ask the same question, does it hold water? Because they know what to do with it and they can put some flowers in it. But it's an object like anything else. Like if it's somewhere you would put a vase of flowers, you can put a ceramic, and it doesn't need to be functional. It can be just sculptural and beautiful. It might be a big thing in the middle of the table. It might be a collection of small bud vases along your mantelpiece.
They can go anywhere.
Yeah, and I think that when you pair ceramics and art, it makes the art look better.
I agree,
they
definitely.
They just speak to each other and it creates this narrative.
Which and it always really looks fantastic. I've done a couple of shows with a ceramicist and I love that conversation between her work and my work. Because sometimes if you just have paintings or drawings on the wall, you think, the gallery seems half empty, and you need the 3D in the room so you can snake people through. And
that's right. Yeah. And I think in the gallery, when you display ceramics and paintings together, it's much more of an environment that is like home. Yeah. No one lives in a big white box with really straight paintings. And I think that when you put ceramics in there, it's like a serving suggestion.
We were just saying, you know, Fenton, we just saw on Instagram lately, they've done these big salon hangs with lots of artists. And it's so clever because it looks like a home. And I think people can go, oh, I could put that with my sofa. And, you know, because essentially, everyone's buying art to put on their walls and buying ceramics to put on their shelves. So it's so funny how galleries don't often take that into consideration about where these things are actually going to be placed. Because in a homeware shop, they'll have beautiful art next to a vase and a thing. But galleries
are much more of a purist environment.
That's right.
And, you know, there are some shows where I do that myself. I think it has to be just about the art. It can't be complicated. Yep. It just, the art is so amazing, it just needs a white wall.
Yeah, and you need the space around it in order to enjoy it.
Yeah, that's right. But we try to present each show quite differently.
Yeah.
And we try to keep interest and diversity between the shows so they never look the same.
I have a bit of a salon hang at home, and I'm a bit of a collector, and I've been trying to just collect works on paper because it's my price range. And I have a husband who's not very happy about keeping to having to drill holes in the wall.
I have one of those, yeah.
I should just learn how to do it myself. But I have the places that I have, and then I get new work. Do you have any advice for sort of rearranging my salon hang easily? Or
I think if you overthink it, it doesn't look as good as if you just whack them up.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's the same in the gallery when Amy and I are doing a salon hang. If you try and be too precise and map it out, it always looks a bit awkward. But when you just hang them intuitively, it just looks amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm the same at home. And I always just find a little spot, and the next one will go in there and, you know, might move one over a bit. And without trying too much.
I'm getting to the point now, though, where it's going to have to start going up another level. And I'm thinking, I did see Luke Scabura's head floor to ceiling.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, if Luke can do it,
you can do it.
My hallway's looking a bit like that at the moment.
You've published some absolutely cracking books.
Thank you.
Clay, Painted Landscape. You've got one coming out on Ken Dome, which I'm so excited about.
She is, honestly. She loves Ken Dome.
And Still Life.
Yes.
Right.
Wait a minute.
No.
Still Life? I didn't know about this.
Yes. So I decided...
Tell us about that.
Normally I wouldn't do two books in 1 year, but I thought after the bushfires and at home schooling, pandemic, work from home husband, that'd be a great time to do two books at once.
Yeah.
So that's what I did this year. Yeah.
Good.
Amazing. It was like a writer's retreat.
Did you just lock yourself into your room?
I hope the tone that I was using on the family around me has not translated into the pages.
Oh, stop. Mummy
is writing a book.
Yeah, I wanted to get a post-it note with, yes, you can have a biscuit, go away.
Yeah. But I figured if I can write books in those conditions, I can write books any time.
That's right. Well, I think mums are very good at not making excuses and just going, I've got 5 minutes, I'm just going to do what I can. Yeah. And you can't have everything perfect all the time.
No.
It's conducive for writing. You just got
to
do it.
Trying to be perfect paralyzes you.
Yeah, that's
true. You just break it into little chunks, you get everything done.
So how did you go about choosing, say, like Painted Landscape? Mm-hmm. How did you go about choosing that? Because obviously
it was hard.
Did you were the only one choosing them?
Oh, yeah. No, Tamsin Hudson are amazing, and they give me full creative reign over the book and who's in it.
Yeah, that must have been tough. I mean, there are so many phenomenal.
Yeah, it was really hard, but I wanted to be very mindful of it not being elitist. I wanted it to be very approachable, so I wanted an even spread of emerging, mid-career, and really, you know, celebrated long-time artists, and I wanted gender... to be balanced, so male and female, and I also wanted gender diversity, ethnicity diversity, style diversity. Yeah. So it was a little bit, unfortunately, not very romantic, a bit of a spreadsheet where I had to really kind of massage it until I felt I had a good mix of all of those factors.
Was it your idea to split them into the rainforest outback?
No.
Oh, so you had to do that.
I didn't necessarily want it to be chunked because I felt like some landscape painters paint rainforests and deserts. And
And
for me, I felt that it fought against me, but everyone who's commented on the book loves that. That segmentation.
I teach from your book quite often.
Do you? Yes. Oh, I love that.
Well, we got taught, didn't we? Because the art class we go to on a Monday, she went through the whole thing. And it was very exciting.
We were pinching each other, okay? Ooh, we're good. Apple.
Nothing thrills me more, and not a day goes past that someone doesn't tag me in something on Instagram to do with my books. And it can be sometimes it's a tag from a country I don't even know what the language is, but they've got a picture of my book and they've tagged me.
They are so well priced as well, which I think must be something I would be proud of, and I reckon you will be.
Well, it's art for everyone. It's not supposed to be.
Because art books, because I have a problem, I have a lot of art books, and they are so expensive. I have to hide the deliveries, yeah, because when my family see a book arrive,
they are, like, but it costs a lot of money to make a book.
It does.
Yes.
But so, I love that these are accessible. They're not stupid money. So, you know, everyone can put them on their Christmas list. And
that's right.
You know,
that's
I really love the front cover of Painted Landscape. I love Mary Tonkin's work.
Oh,
and
so
I think,
do I.
Oh, my God. And I had heard of her before, but I didn't know much about her. And when I saw the cover, I was like, who is that?
Yeah, that's like, a great
it was,
cover.
Yeah, it's a bloody good cover.
And it was one of those things, you sort of, you write the book and you do the design and everything, and the cover choice is always the last thing. And I had Mary in my mind from the beginning, and I absolutely wanted a female. And Thames and Hudson wasn't convinced at the beginning. I think they wanted, there was a couple of male artists from the book that they probably had in mind. And I really put my foot down. I said, no, this is the painting and this is the artist that I want. And my publisher said, okay, look, I'm going to trust you. I'll stick my neck out for you. And I think it's what's so beautiful about that book is that cover. Everyone
it's
remembers
eye-catching.
It
it's so Australian, that
it
painting.
It is so Australian, yeah, and you get lost in it. And Mary is such a beautiful person. Like, she was exactly the right person for that. For
and me. How did you go about researching and planning the writing? So did you interview people? Some of the photographs are great. I love the shots. Some of the artists, I love the fact that they look like they're really natural in the landscape, but others are looking a bit like...
Well, because a lot of them are out in the landscape by themselves, so they're trying... And also, I think the hard thing with landscape painters is that when they're out there painting the landscape, the last thing they're thinking about is having a photo session.
Yeah.
And I guess the logistically, when we were putting the book together, is it didn't always align with when they were out painting...
Of course.
...somewhere in the country. It was quite challenging to get the right sort of photos that we needed. And, you know, many of them had done amazing trips but didn't have a photo to show for it.
No.
Whereas others, particularly the younger ones, are very good at documenting themselves in the landscape.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Would you say that artists graduating now have to be on social media?
Oh, I think it helps. Yeah. I think it has made them very savvy promoters or savvy self-promoters. They understand branding, they understand an aesthetic, and I think it shapes their mind. They're presenting themselves as I don't quite know how to say it, but I think it does help.
I think people can see the authenticity now, though. I think
it shows behind
the understanding the bullshit, you know, that whether someone's truly telling their story or they think they're telling the story people want to hear.
Overly produced feeds don't do anything for
nasty.
Me.
Yeah.
I love it when people are sharing warts and all, works in progress, painting failures, on location painting, mixing paint. One of the painters that we show with Michael Reed Studio Direct is Dylan Jones, who is a Queensland painter, and he mixes all his paint from scratch, and he does lots of videos on Instagram where he shares his process, and it's fascinating. And I love it, and it helps you engage. And I own one of those paintings, and I love knowing that all of that work went into that painting.
Yes, because I suppose being an artist has been quite elusive for a long time, and it's been you know, I suppose back then it was elevated to this point of the artist and, you know, in the creative space. And to just see, for people, I think a lot of people don't really understand what artists do. A lot of people are like, what do you do? I'm like, I don't know, I have no idea. Like, I just turn up and I paint and, you know. But people are fascinated by how that happens. And as an artist, I love watching a YouTube video or an Instagram video of someone painting. You're like, oh, they use that. And it's taught me that you can do anything.
Yeah,
you don't have to. You know, the older you get, you go, I don't have to do that. Why did I think I, you know, had to do that as an artist or had to be that way?
Like, you don't have to lay out a palette. We were watching an Idris Murphy video and we're like, oh, he's mixing up in a, you know, old...
dirty brushes.
Guacamole, you know, pot and dirty water and splashing it on. And when we interviewed Catherine Cassidy, she was the same. She's like, I don't use a palette.
Well, Ken Doan mixes on sand spades. bucket, yes, from Buckets and Spades that, yeah, he finds on the beach near his house.
Does he really?
You have a great photo of that in the painted landscape, yes, don't you?
He's got a whole wall hung with
spades. He collects little kiddie spades from the beach.
What a ledge.
I know.
Okay, tell me more about Ken Day.
Yeah,
Come on.
It's such a bucket list project. So Ken was obviously in a painted landscape and we just loved working with him, yeah, so much. He was just such a gentleman and so interesting and... my book designer also bought one of his paintings from the book launch exhibition that I put on, and so we were just speaking amongst ourselves about how great it would be to put on a, you know, do a book just about Ken, and it just so happened that he was turning 80, so we thought it would be about time to do a monograph and really talk about his life and his art and his design,
yeah,
and make a really beautiful, surprising book, because I think a lot of people think they know Ken Doane because they owned a doona or they've got a swimming costume from the 80s, and he's... It's just you.
He's
you
so much more layered than that, isn't
absolutely.
I think he gets put into the
merchandise.
Yeah, the circular key shops.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Which is not fair because he is.
Well, I think people resent his success, but I think very early, Ken didn't have his first exhibition until his 40th birthday.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. So wow. He had a whole life before he started selling his paintings, but he also very quickly made a decision that he wanted to own his own gallery, and he compared it to a chef owning, yeah, their own restaurant. Why can't an artist own their own gallery? So it removed the restrictions of a curator and a art dealer making, yeah, decisions about when and what to sell. He just had the freedom to paint and sell his work as he pleased, and, you know, it served him well.
Mm. Well, and also I think a lot of artists, people get so weird about people being commercial, and it's like, well, no other job... You get, yeah, slated for actually trying to make ends meet. We live in Sydney. It's pretty impossible to live here without making some sort of money from what you do. And people yeah, still, I think, get that romantic ideal of...
you should be
not the starving artist,
yeah,
or anything like that, but, like, it's sort of... You can't have a commercial side of your practice, which I think is just crazy.
It's very judgy.
Yeah, it is. Judgy. It is.
But spending that time with Ken in his studio and rifling through his drawers, there are paintings and drawings in there that would just blow your mind, and they are not what you would expect.
Did he know you were rifling through his drawers, Amber?
Yeah. Yes, I had permission.
It just sounds like such a fab guy, and I look at some of his work and think, wow, like, people are just doing that now. Like, he was a little bit before his time, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of millennials now who don't have that attachment to memories of the 80s when a lot of people associate Ken Doane, you know, he was everywhere and the Olympics and...
But he's so good at colour. Mm. He is just one of the masters of colour, like
absolutely.
David Hockney.
Yeah.
Don't say it.
I love David Hockney.
We know.
Yeah.
I know, but I just love David Hockney.
Oh, my God.
But it's funny because there are these people who were born in, you know, the year 2000 who just don't have that association, but they've discovered Ken. You know, they think they've discovered Ken Doane, and he's having this whole beautiful renaissance, which
That's
is
great.
Lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose most artists, like, there was times when David Hockney, we all like David Hockney.
Not as much
went
as me.
Up and down in his... You know,
popularity.
Well, that's right. But if you're not striving to do new things and things that you want to do, you will just paint the same thing forever.
Yeah.
And it's like any band, they put out an experimental album and everyone will still listen to it, but they've learned from that. They might not sell as much and everyone goes nuts, but then they grow from it and I don't know. It seems like that's what he's done. He's sort of been his own man.
That's right.
Yeah, and I guess because he had the gallery, he had the freedom to do that. And when he was selling a lot of work, why is it in Australia, or is it global, that success is... often not celebrated. Other people's
success.
I think
it is in other countries. I think in America.
Oh, the UK, they shoot you down within a second.
In the UK, it is I reckon the UK is the worst in the world. That they build you up, the press there, and then they smash you to the ground.
That tall poppy thing.
Oh, it's evil.
Is that what they did to you, Fee?
Yeah, actually, I'm still recovering.
Yeah, you know? I thought so, darling. And Michael Reed sounds like an absolute dude. I listened to a podcast with him the other day that he did on Regionally Speaking. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Yeah. I thought it was very interesting.
He's amazing, and I'm so lucky that I get to work with Michael. For the 5 or 6 years I was an independent curator, and I was sort of morphing into different spaces and, you know, taking hold of different galleries and whatnot. And then one day Michael just sort of tap me on the shoulder. I can't remember how it all came about, but he said that he liked my magpie eye and would I like to come and do what I'm doing with him and sort of, you know, build this program for emerging artists. And I probably would have said no, except that he was so compelling and he's so clever and smart, and he never stops. And but his mind never stops, and it's contagious. And to be in his orb is very
exciting. A bit of a Richard Branson, isn't he? He's so creative.
Yeah,
that's the vibe I get from. I haven't met him, but I feel like
That would be not a bad comparison.
I think maybe I'm likening him to Richard Branson because he said he's dyslexic, and I think that a lot of dyslexic people are so creative and they're not afraid to just keep punching out new ideas. I love that he's got an arm to all of the business. You know, the fact that he's come up with the delivery,
the courier. The shuttle,
bring it on.
Yeah.
You know, we cover it all. Come to the gallery, have a beautiful meal and buy a piece of art and I'll deliver it for you.
Yeah, he's not short of an idea, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's great.
And he's not controlling. He's very happy to let his staff.
Yeah.
But I think that's what good leaders do.
I agree.
They let you do what you're best at. For the benefit of the business.
Definitely.
So, I mean, how often do people come along and let you have a gallery curating the art that you want and bankrolling it, basically? So it's
very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is very exciting. And speaking of exciting, Michael Reed Direct, what can you share with us that is coming up there?
Ooh, lots of things.
So right now,
we're just installing Katie Eraser.
Yes,
an amazing,
very cool.
I'm so excited that Katie Eraser has come to Newport.
Yes,
it's going to give Newport a real
It packs a punch, that show. Unfortunately, she can't join us because she's locked down. But yeah, it's looking amazing, beautiful, zesty, colourful, attitude-y kind of show.
Awesome marks. She's very energetic.
So it looks great. And then in December we've got an amazing group show of all of our artists that we have pulled together that happen to also live in the Northern Beaches.
Brilliant.
Yes, there are a lot of Northern Beaches artists, isn't there?
There are.
That's great.
And that was just a coincidence, but we thought, you know, what a great way to wrap up the year, bring them all together and show them in the space.
So will all of your artists get some sort of show next year? Is that how it works?
We don't represent anyone, and in a lot of times we sort of they come into the Michael Reed network. So a lot of the studio direct artists have come in and then they've showed at Murrurundi, or they're showing at Berlin at the moment, so they will show with us again, but sometimes they just come and it might be just a one-off show. And other times we just form a really great relationship.
But that gives them the flexibility, because I think that sometimes you don't want to be represented, because then you're tied. And I think a lot of young artists particularly don't want that, because I think the times have changed and the buying of art is so different now. So I can see how some...
It's clever. And there are some small galleries in Sydney who do represent artists, and I don't know why, because there's only so many artists you can show in a year. So if you're representing them, you've got to be able to make it worth the artist's while. Otherwise, they're shooting themselves in the foot because they can't show go and show elsewhere.
Yeah.
So I like the way we work, and I think it's a nice way of bringing in the emerging artists, giving them a great show, and they can go on their way or they can show with us again.
That's right.
We're not placing restrictions on them.
So is there going to be a Michael Reed Direct in Melbourne, maybe, or...?
Who knows? There's some big plans afoot that I can't speak of yet. But
That's exciting.
What do we have to do? Champagne. Get the champagne.
Well, Amber, thank you so much.
So,
that was wonderful.
So much.
Thanks for having me.
Hopefully it was an informal chat. I think it was very enjoyable.
And actually, this is the first time we've had the headphones on.
It was easier to hear the sound. Thank you.